From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a shooting spree at a U.S. military base, world financial impact of the Crimean crisis, violence leaves CAR residents in perpetual fear, plus seeking lessons of the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Law enforcement officials say a gunman opened fire at the Fort Hood military base that's in the U.S. state of Texas. It happened Wednesday, killing at least three people before taking his own life. As many as 14 others were wounded. President Obama was traveling in the city of Chicago, Illinois, when he learned of the shooting.
We're heartbroken that something like this might have happened again. And I don't want to comment on the facts until I know exactly what has happened. But for now, I would just hope that everybody across the country is keeping the families and the community of Fort Hood in our thoughts and in our prayers. The folks there have sacrificed so much on behalf of our freedom. Many of the people there have been through multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. They serve with valor. And they serve with distinction. And when they're at their home base, they need to feel safe.
Fort Hood was the scene of a mass shooting spree in 2009. 13 people were killed and more than 30 others wounded when an Army psychiatrist opened fire on personnel. After that shooting, the Pentagon ordered tightened security at all U.S. military bases. VOA will stay on top of this story for you. We'll have the latest in our hourly news reports on the radio and, of course, on the internet at voanews.com. Middle East peace negotiations are in crisis just a month before a looming deadline for an agreement. Robert Berger has been sampling reaction among Israelis and Palestinians and filed this report from the VOA Jerusalem Bureau.
Peace talks mediated by the United States are in danger of collapse after Israel failed to release 26 Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian officials reacted angrily and renewed their bid for recognition of the State of Palestine in international forums, which could enable them to pursue war crimes charges against Israel. Following the Palestinian announcement, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry abruptly canceled a visit to the West Bank. Kerry is pushing for a framework peace agreement by the end of April that would extend peace talks into next year. But the gaps are wide. Ordinary Israelis and Palestinians have been skeptical about the talks since they resumed in July after a five-year deadlock, and the latest snag comes as no surprise. At the checkpoint into the West Bank town of Bethlehem, Palestinian computer programmer Salah Zaharan blamed Secretary of State Kerry for failing to pressure Israel.
He has the power to force the Israelis to follow the peace process correctly. He has the power to do this, but we didn't feel that he is serious to do this.
Palestinian student Razi Abu Tir says Israel's failure to release the prisoners shows it is not negotiating in good faith.
If Israelis claim that they want peace, I don't think the language of ultimatums is the one to be used. I think it's improper, it's threatening.
In Jewish West Jerusalem, accountant Larry Kaufman said the Arab Spring revolutions and the strife in Syria, Iraq, and Egypt show the peace process is a farce.
How can we really have an arrangement? How can we have an agreement with the Palestinians in this supposed two-state solution when you turn on your television and see them killing each other? And, it's just an untenable situation.
Devorah Alon is an Israeli housewife.
I'm not optimistic about peace at all because we don't have a peace partner. There's an element that's always referred to as our peace partner, but we know that they're not really looking for peace.
Despite the deep suspicion and skepticism, polls show that many Israelis and Palestinians still support the negotiations. After a long period of calm in Israel and the West Bank, many people concede that talking is better than fighting. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Egyptian state media reporting a series of explosions near Cairo University that killed a police official and wounded five other officers. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reporting now from Cairo.
Egyptian security officials say two homemade bombs went off in quick succession Wednesday morning, hitting riot police stationed outside the university because of near-daily anti-government protests by students. About 2 hours later, another smaller bomb exploded in the same area. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. Security forces have been the target of frequent attacks since the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi last year and the continuing crackdown on his supporters in the Muslim Brotherhood and others opposed to Egypt's military-backed government. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Russia is accusing NATO of reverting to Cold War rhetoric and tactics by suspending cooperation with Russia over its seizure of Crimea. Russia's foreign ministry spokesperson Alexander Lukashevich said in a statement on Wednesday that NATO's language on the issue resembled the verbal jousting of the Cold War era. NATO foreign ministers announced on Tuesday during a summit on Ukraine taking place in Brussels that they would officially end all civilian and military cooperation with Russia. Meantime, the International Monetary Fund managing director Christine Lagarde said on Wednesday that as the world struggles to emerge from the 2008 financial crisis, economies are under threat from tensions involving Ukraine and Russia's annexation of Crimea.
Our hope for the program for Ukraine to work, and I'm looking, you know, with my narrow lenses of economic and financial stability, is that geopolitical tensions go away, come down, so that that country and its people can actually recover.
Return to the Soviet Union has been the buzz phrase for an emboldened Russia under President Vladimir Putin since the start of the Crimean crisis. We get more now from VOA's Michael Eccles in Moscow.
History professor Andrei Zubov was fired from the Moscow State Institute for Foreign Relations for a newspaper article comparing Russian President Vladimir Putin's actions in Ukraine to Adolf Hitler's Anschluss. He gave two reasons for writing it. Zubov said he wanted to see how far Russia had come from the Soviet era. He wrote the article as a message and an experiment. Zubov's dismissal and the recent crackdown on press independence, TV Rain, and Lenta.ru demonstrates tightening control over dissent, reminiscent of Soviet times. But according to Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Center, there are crucial differences with contemporary Russia, especially lack of ideology.
Socialist, communist, however you call it, but there was a clear set of ideas, of formula, of tenets that was radically different from those of the West.
The West, however, remains the primary antagonist. The Russian parliament is pushing criminal legislation to mandate the disclosure of dual citizenship. Mr. Putin had a few comments. He said Russians have the right to know who's living in their country and what they're up to, and that dual citizens must be kept track of. Zubov has a simple explanation for the government's reliance on old paradigms. The middle and older generations are used to thinking in the Soviet fashion and are not accustomed to new ideas, he said. Aimed primarily at Ukrainian-Russian dual citizens, the Carnegie Center's Lipman additionally sees this as a turn away from the international Soviet identity.
The developments in the Crimea are pushing him and Russia in general towards something that is that looks increasingly nativist.
A move toward ethnic nationalist policy could be dangerous for a Russia just as diverse as its predecessor. Meanwhile, old methods remain at the ready for new ideas in development. Michael Eccles, Voice of America, Moscow, Russia.
U.S. space agency NASA is suspending most of its work with Russia's space program in the wake of the Russian actions in Ukraine. However, NASA says the two nations will continue to work together on the International Space Station. Station crew currently in orbit includes both U.S. and Russian astronauts. Tens of thousands of Chileans who fled to higher ground on Tuesday after a powerful offshore earthquake triggered Pacific tsunami warnings have begun returning to their homes as authorities are surveying the damage.
El país sufrió un terremoto en el norte de 8.3 grados Richter.
President Michelle Bachelet visited the region struck by the quake on Wednesday and described the areas affected by the 8.2 magnitude earthquake. At least six people were reported dead after being crushed by collapsing walls or experiencing heart attacks. The quake was centered off the northern coast of Chile and the Pacific Ocean. Authorities in the area discovered surprisingly little damage from the quake, considering its strength. The strongest earthquake ever recorded happened in Chile. It was a magnitude 9.5 tremor in 1960 that killed more than 5,000 people. Hundreds of earthquakes have shaken Chile's far northern coast just in the past 2 weeks. Also in the news, the International Committee of the Red Cross is warning the humanitarian crisis in the Central African Republic will get worse without major efforts to restore security in the CAR. Lisa Schlein reporting now from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the people of Central African Republic are held hostage to pillaging, killings, and sexual violence meted out by the warring factions. The ICRC head of operations for Central and Southern Africa, Patrick Lott, has just returned from a four-day visit to the country. He tells VOA, people live in a state of constant danger. Survival is their only mode of existence.
What's going on now between communities is very difficult and puts the people in a very difficult situation. The fear for their life, they are put under a lot of pressure during the day, but also during the night. And this takes place in a country which was already before the events in a state of extreme poverty.
Lott says this pervasive fear affects every aspect of society and hampers the ability to provide humanitarian aid. He says local health workers are under enormous pressure during the day while treating the sick and wounded.
But they also experience a difficult situation in their private life during the night when they are with their family, fearing for their life or for their belongings, and sometimes forced to flee their home on a very short notice.
The Red Cross was present in the country before this current war broke out at the end of 2012. This made it easy for the agency to move smoothly from a traditional to an emergency operation as the crisis grew. The agency's main focus is on the health sector. It has three surgical teams working around the clock at the community hospital in the capital, Bangui. It says around 70% of those receiving emergency care are victims of shootings or stabbings. The ICRC also provides medical care in other parts of the country, such as the town of Kagabandoro and in Indele in the north. But operations head Lott says the Red Cross's traditional role as neutral mediator between warring parties is difficult to perform in the CAR.
You don't have two well-defined groups fighting against each other. You have a combination of different factions, groups, and criminality also is rising up in the present days, so it has a real effect on the deterioration of the situation.
Lott says impunity in the country is widespread. He says that people feel they can do whatever they want and will not have to pay a price for their actions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
African and European leaders are focusing on the Central African Republic crisis at a summit in Brussels. European Union has agreed to deploy a temporary force of up to 1,000 troops to that troubled area. They will join about 6,000 African Union and 2,000 French troops that have been trying to protect civilians and disarm militias. The foreign peacekeepers are currently focused on protecting Muslims who are being attacked by mostly Christian anti-Balaka militants. Tens of thousands of Muslims have fled their homes in recent months, with many of them taking refuge in neighboring countries. The anti-Balaka militia formed last year in response to a wave of killings and looting by mostly Muslim Salika rebels. 2 decades have passed since thousands of people were killed in the Rwanda genocide, and Western powers are accused of standing by and allowing it to happen. As VOA's Kent Klein reports, experts say there are lessons to be learned on how to prevent such tragedies in the future.
The world was shocked when an estimated 800,000 Rwandans were massacred in about 100 days, starting April 7, 1994. Members of the ethnic Hutu majority killed about 70% of the minority Tutsis living in Rwanda and many moderate Hutus. U.S. President Bill Clinton was criticized at home and abroad for doing nothing to stop the slaughter. 4 years later, he visited Rwanda and apologized for his inaction.
We did not act quickly enough after the killing began. But all over the world, there were people like me sitting in offices day after day after day who did not fully appreciate the depth and the speed with which you were being engulfed by this unimaginable terror.
Despite the vow of never again, the catastrophe in Rwanda did not bring the end of widespread violence against civilians. Genocide in Sudan's Darfur region and sectarian violence in the Central African Republic are among the acts of mass brutality since then that have left millions dead or homeless. In the Syrian civil war, at least 150,000 people are believed to have been killed, and another U.S. president has been accused of inaction. Amnesty International's Adote Akwe says opposition from Russia in the United Nations Security Council is blocking White House efforts to stop the violence in Syria.
The international community has to end the crisis in Syria somehow, and the administration has been consistent in trying to do that, but it's not been able to actually achieve the results that we all want to see.
Veteran U.S. diplomat Johnny Carson, now a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute for Peace, says the Rwanda genocide taught the world it has to move quickly.
Act swiftly and to muster the resources of the international community to condemn and engage as quickly as possible when we see an atrocity about to occur.
Ambassador Carson says the lessons of Rwanda and other massacres led President Barack Obama to establish an Atrocities Prevention Board,
which is an interagency group that gets together once a month under the direction of the National Security Council to review situations around the world that may be likely to turn into atrocities or mass violence.
Akwe says the board is a major step forward, but efforts to prevent atrocities must start sooner.
It would be better and probably more economical to try to challenge intolerance and hate propaganda earlier on, before all of the actors are in place, when things are actually beginning to threaten people.
Akwe says the best way to prevent genocide is to show that the world is watching and will not tolerate it. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday issued an important ruling that further loosens restrictions on campaign contribution limits, possibly opening the way for even greater influence by wealthy donors. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
By a vote of 5-4, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court struck down overall limits on campaign contributions for individual donors who wish to support federal candidates, political parties, and political action committees.
The previous overall limit for any one donor during a two-year election cycle was $123,200. The High Court decision opens the way for wealthy donors to contribute millions of dollars to various campaigns and political parties, an influence that has grown since another sweeping campaign finance decision by the Supreme Court in 2010. Wednesday's ruling does not do away with current restrictions on contributions to individual candidates, which remains set at $2,600 per candidate per election cycle. The ruling got a favorable reaction from Republicans, including National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus, who spoke to reporters in a conference call.
The First Amendment applies to all of us. People should have the right to give their money and exercise their free speech to as many candidates and as many political committees and PACs as they want to.
Democrats blasted the narrow decision as a defeat for the average voter and a victory for wealthy donors looking to have undue influence on U.S. elections. Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York was critical of the conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
They wish to dismantle all limits on giving, piece by piece, until we are back to the days of the robber barons, when anyone or anything could give unlimited money, undisclosed, and make our political system seem so rigged that everyone will lose interest in our democracy.
The decision also drew negative reviews from various groups that support strengthening campaign finance laws to guard against political corruption. Marge Baker is with People for the American Way in Washington. She says this latest high court ruling could fire up grassroots support for tougher laws and restrictions to guard against buying influence with political candidates.
There is a movement building around the country calling for addressing the huge money in politics problem that we have, and that movement is growing every day.
But conservative Republicans in Congress are likely to block any attempt in the near future to tighten campaign finance laws. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is a longtime critic of campaign finance reform. He equates giving political contributions to the free speech guarantee in the U.S. Constitution.
There are many wealthy Americans who feel deeply about the country, who are committed to one side or the other, who are trying to have an impact on the country. As many on the left as on the right.
Senator McConnell was a supporter of the controversial Supreme Court decision 4 years ago, known as Citizens United, that removed a number of restrictions on corporations and labor unions that wish to spend money on campaign advocacy as long as it is independent of specific candidates. Outside political groups and individual wealthy donors have played a bigger role in recent national elections, and in some cases have become as influential as the two main political parties in terms of fundraising. Polls show Americans are concerned about the growing influence of wealthy campaign donors, but the issue ranks low on the list of priorities for most voters. This latest high court ruling continues to reverse a trend that began in the 1970s, when Congress enacted stricter campaign finance laws in the wake of the political scandal that drove then-President Richard Nixon from office. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak visited the Australian search base for missing Flight 370 today as a nuclear-powered submarine joined the near four-week-old search for Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777. The plane with 239 people aboard lost communications, disappeared from civilian radar less than an hour into an overnight flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing back on March 8th. Up to eight planes and nine ships joined today's search, that is, of a 223,000-square-kilometer area west-northwest of Perth, Australia. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here today for International Edition on The Voice of America. Very good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. And I hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Altayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On April 3, 1860, a temporary mail service was inaugurated to span the gap in the telegraph line across the American West. The Pony Express was a relay of riders and horses that, in about 10 days, could cover the 2,700-kilometer distance between St. Joseph, Missouri and Sacramento, California. In 1882, American outlaw, robber, and murderer Jesse James was killed by fellow gangster Robert Ford. After his death, Jesse James became one of the legendary figures of the American Wild West. In 1922, Joseph Stalin was appointed General Secretary of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. Stalin was dictator of the Soviet Union from the mid-1920s until his death in 1953. He led the Soviets to victory over Nazi Germany, but his cruel regime caused the death and suffering of tens of millions of people. On this day in 1942, the Japanese Army staged a major offensive against Allied troops in Bataan, the peninsula around Manila Bay in the Philippines. The all-out assault would result 6 days later in the surrender of the largest number of U.S. troops in military history. In 1948, President Harry Truman signed the European Recovery Program into law, better known as the Marshall Plan after the man who proposed it, Secretary of State George Marshall. The legislation provided billions of dollars in aid for the devastated countries in Europe after World War II. In 1975, world chess champion Bobby Fischer refused to accept the format of a series of chess matches against Anatoly Karpov, thus resigning his title to the Russian master. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, positioned as it is between two great oceans, knows the importance of maritime security to the continued success of our own country and of the rest of the world. 90% of world trade is conducted on the oceans, said Acting Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs Tom Kelly. Maritime trade is our nation's lifeblood. Keeping the oceans free for commerce, in two words, maritime security, is key to our national security. In the not-too-distant past, maritime security was seen as a set of military and law enforcement issues, such as threats from other states, terrorist activity, unregulated fishing, and organized criminal activity, including smuggling and piracy. Today, we know that maritime security is a far more complex issue that includes mass migration, climate change, and natural and man-made disasters. So, for example, typhoons may close down shipping lanes, mercury and oil leaks endanger global food supply chains, and climate change causes ice caps and glaciers to melt, raising water levels and shifting shipping lanes. 5 years ago, the governments of all maritime powers were reminded of an important lesson, that great problems are more easily solved when countries work together. In 2009, the United States helped to establish the Contact Group on Piracy off the coast of Somalia, which coordinated multinational naval patrols and drastically reduced the threat of hijackings by Somali pirates. Today, we fully appreciate that our own maritime security depends on our foreign policy. And because some of the busiest and most heavily used shipping lanes lie in the Asia-Pacific region, the United States is working with its partners to strengthen their maritime capacities. So, for example, $40 million in new regional and bilateral assistance to improve maritime security in the Philippines complements a $32 million regional assistance package aimed at helping Southeast Asian nations improve their maritime domain awareness and better protect their territorial waters. We are also building a cooperative partnership with China to better manage critical global challenges such as piracy, climate change, and wildlife trafficking. Global maritime security is an essential element of American security and prosperity, said Acting Assistant Secretary Kelly. Accordingly, the United States will continue to work with our partners to strengthen maritime capacities in the Asia-Pacific and across the globe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.